You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, do you enjoy listening to Kick-Ass News? Well, then become a part of what I'm doing here and help support the show by going to patreon.com/kickassnews and making a donation. Your encouragement and support is always appreciated. And now, enjoy the podcast. On January 7th, 2015, two brothers stormed the Paris offices of satiric magazine Charlie Hebdo, killing 11 people and a French police officer in an act of retribution for the magazine's publishing of cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Amidst the massive manhunt for the killers, an additional 5 people were murdered in related attacks over the next 2 days, including a harrowing standoff between police and a third gunman at a kosher grocery store in Paris. A new HBO documentary recounts this 3-day ordeal that began with an attack by men acting in the name of Al-Qaeda and ended with the first ISIS attack in Paris, a chilling precursor of other terrorist acts to come. 3 days of terror, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, draws on exclusive access to hostages, survivors, police, paramilitary forces, intelligence findings, and evidence, as well as never-before-seen footage and photographs, spotlighting the courage and resilience of Parisian police and citizens in the face of terror. 3 Days of Terror airs tonight, September 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern on HBO, and today I'll talk with the filmmaker Dan Reed. Reed was nominated for Emmy Awards for his other HBO documentaries, Terror in Mumbai, which chronicled the 2008 massacre of 164 people in India by Islamic extremists, and for Terror in the Mall about the 2013 attack by Al-Shabaab on a Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi, Kenya, which left 67 people dead and 175 people wounded. He's also received 4 BAFTA TV awards from the British Academy of Film and Television Arts for his documentaries The Pedophile Hunter, Terror in Mumbai, and an episode of the British docu-series Dispatches titled The Battle for Haiti. He's received an additional 4 BAFTA nominations for his work on those films and for his documentaries The Valley and Terror in Moscow. Today I'll talk with Dan Reed about his latest film, 3 Days of Terror, The Charlie Hebdo Attacks, and the satiric cartoons that served as the catalyst for the massacre of 10 of the magazine's employees. We'll talk about the sympathy attacks by a third terrorist, which turned out to be the Islamic State's first assault on the French homeland, and how it's led to a mass exodus of Paris's Jews. We also discuss simmering tensions between France and its Muslim population, both before and after the attacks, as well as the government's controversial ban on hijab and burkinis, and the second wave of deadly Paris attacks that once again caught French authorities off guard just 10 months after Charlie Hebdo. Plus, we'll talk about the broader issue of freedom of speech and how Dan's home country of Great Britain is handling Islamic extremism and homeland security, and we'll also get around to his thoughts on the Brexit fallout, coming up with documentary filmmaker Dan Reed in just a moment. I'm talking today with the Emmy-nominated filmmaker Dan Reed. He has a new documentary called 3 Days of Terror, The Charlie Hebdo Attacks, which airs Monday, September 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Dan, thanks for joining me.
Hi there.
This film covers the 2015 Charlie Hebdo terrorist attacks that happened in Paris and the subsequent manhunt. Now, most Americans prior to 2015 probably were not familiar with Charlie Hebdo, and some still may not be. So briefly remind us, who or what is Charlie Hebdo?
Charlie Hebdo was a very French institution. It was a very small and at the time of the attacks, struggling satirical magazine. So a combination of text and a lot of cartoons. It was kind of born in the 60s as an outgrowth of the 60s protest movements and sort of revolutionary spirit. And a lot of the cartoons were very, very irreverent. I mean, really quite provocative. They seemed to have absolutely no fear of anyone or anything.
Yeah. What exactly were the cartoons that led to this? Were they particularly offensive?
To be perfectly honest, I think a couple of them really were. If I had been a Muslim, I think I would certainly be offended by a couple of them. There are a whole bunch of them that perhaps, you know, in my view, were certainly much less offensive. But, you know, this is a magazine that had satirized the Catholic Church. It had satirized Jews. It had satirized all political parties. It was a magazine really that kind of its raison d'etre was to poke vicious fun at everyone and everything.
So they were equal opportunity offenders.
They were, and they were in pretty bad taste some of the time. But sometimes, you know, they were very much right on the mark. So, you know, you can see even today they do some pretty bad taste cartoons about the latest one, I think, was about the Italian earthquake. So they do regularly offend, regularly and reliably offend. And I think that's why they had a readership. But at the time of the attacks, as I say, they were struggling. Their readership had declined. They didn't have a lot of money.
Interesting.
And in fact, ironically, the attacks served to boost them.
Was there some kind of perverse benefit to the magazine after this?
Hugely so. I mean, the attacks created a huge outpouring of sympathy and money, and that money swelled the coffers of Charlie Hebdo, created actually an internal battle between the management and the employees, but certainly led to a real spike in the fortunes of the magazine, which is presumably what Al-Qaeda in the Yemen, who had organized the attack, was trying to avoid.
I've been trying to think of what the equivalent would be for us here in America. I guess it would the closest thing I could think of would be if ISIS or Al-Qaeda decided to attack The Onion. You know, for a satirical column or something.
The Onion meets Mad Magazine or something.
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Now, you've covered similar subject matter in the past. You've done documentaries about the Mumbai attacks, the terrorist attacks in the mall in Kenya in 2013, the Chechen terrorist attacks that happened in the Moscow theater. In all of those cases, those victims happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. They picked the wrong day to go to the theater or the wrong day to go shopping. But in this case with Charlie Hebdo, the victims were very deliberately targeted. Did that lead you to approach this particular story any differently?
I mean, it lent a different flavor, certainly, to the first story. So the 3 days of terror that the title alludes to there, a Wednesday, a Thursday, a Friday in Paris in January 2015. And so the first attack is a targeted attack, as you point out, against the offices of the magazine Charlie Hebdo. So the gunmen come looking for specific people, actually, by name. And they kill 10 people inside the offices and two more nearby. And then 2 days later, on the Friday, there is this attack on the kosher deli.
Right.
It's targeted at Jews, you know, doing their shopping before the Sabbath. So you're absolutely right to say that in Mumbai and in Nairobi, the attacks were more random. The Charlie Hebdo attack was kind of like an old-fashioned targeted terrorist attack. It targeted people who had drawn the wrath of the organization and
I mean, it was almost like a hit because they were being punished for a specific act.
It was. It was exactly that. And in that sense, it was kind of old-fashioned terrorism because the kind of terrorism we see with the Islamic State, ISIS or ISIL, as you call it, here in the States, is much less targeted. I mean, certainly Charlie Hebdo would have been a target for ISIL as well. But no, this was a kind of an old-fashioned, very targeted attack against people who were kind of bugbears. You know, the Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which was the organization that sent the Kouachi brothers to kill the Charlie Hebdo journalists. They had published in their magazine that they wanted to kill these people. So it was no secret.
Yeah, and this was not the first time that Charlie Hebdo had been attacked for publishing depictions of Muhammad, right? This had happened before, a couple
Correct.
Of years prior, right?
Correct. Their offices had been burnt down. They'd received death threats. I mean, they had routine death threats all the time from unknown people. But yeah, they'd had to. Their offices had been destroyed by fire, and they'd moved to this new location in a fairly anonymous building, in a building belonging to the city of Paris. And they kept a really low profile, so much so that, in fact, the local police department wasn't aware that they were there, or that, you know, the officers on the street, the patrol officers, were not aware that Charlie Hebdo was at that location, which had tragic consequences.
Yeah. Did they have extra security measures in place, given that this had happened before?
Well, they didn't. There was no extra security on the door. The building hadn't been adapted or modified in any way to provide greater security.
Who were the perpetrators?
So, as you say, there were two gunmen, and they were French-born young men in their 30s of Algerian descent. They were orphans, so they'd lost their mother and father, and had grown up in institutional care, I think. And there are all sorts of rumors about their mother. I didn't look into this in any detail, but their mother being, you know, they were at some point in sole charge of their mother after their father left, and there were rumors that she'd resorted to prostitution. And these kids came from a troubled background, these young men.
And they were French citizens. They were not immigrants.
They were homegrown, if you like. One of them was implicated in a terrorist conspiracy. You know, he's on the fringes of it, and he went to jail. And that's where he met Koulibaly, who's the perpetrator of the second attack, the one against the kosher deli. And so the two teams kind of knew each other, had prior acquaintance, although they weren't working together. And the just going back to the Charlie Hebdo attackers, so there were two brothers. The older one was kind of more serious and restrained and did less shooting, and then the younger one was pretty enthusiastic, and he was the one who went into the Charlie Hebdo conference room and gunned everyone down.
And they claimed that they were affiliated with Al-Qaeda in Yemen. Was there a direct affiliation with Al-Qaeda, or was it more the case that they were sympathizers or inspired by Al-Qaeda?
No, there was a direct affiliation. One of them had made a trip to Yemen, and they were at pains to state that the terrorist hit had been financed by Anwar al-Awlaki, who's an American, actually, who, interestingly, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, was seen as by the U.S. government as a very loyal Muslim, and he was sort of seen to be on the side of the good guys and the angels, and he was trotted out here now and again as an example of a Muslim that was politically acceptable to the U.S. government, and then he had this huge change of heart, and ended up in Yemen and ended up coordinating a lot of these very I don't want to say successful, but very lethal plots, including the Charlie Hebdo killing. So the direct contact between Al-Qaeda in the Yemen and one of the Kouachi brothers occurred, I think, in 2006, a good many years before the attack.
Now, after they attacked the offices, they fled Paris, and they could have stayed on the run for a while. It didn't sound like the authorities were very close to catching up with them. But at one point, they decided to walk into a print shop in the town of Demartin, and they told the owner to call the police and essentially said, "Here we are, come and get us."
Exactly.
There was no rush for them to become martyrs. They probably could have fled and maybe even have escaped the country. Why did they choose to provoke a showdown at that point?
Well, the whole point, the kind of philosophy of these attacks is to go in and you kill your targets, or you cause as much mayhem as you can. And then the expectation is that you will die at the hands of the enemy. So you kind of die kind of in combat, if you like. And this is a pattern in all of the terrorist attacks that I've made documentaries about for HBO, four of them now. So these are not suicide bombers. They're not going to blow themselves up. They are a kind of suicide infantry in the sense that they go out in the expectation of dying in a hail of bullets at the end of the operation. And in fact, that death is a condition. In Mumbai, there was this famous line of, you know, your mission is not successful until you die. And so the Quashu brothers expected to die. I think they probably expected to die a lot sooner than they actually did. I think they might have expected a strong police response immediately after the Charlie Hebdo massacre. Instead, they ended up wandering around the countryside and spending nights in a forest outside Paris. And I think, you know, they raided a gas station to get some snacks. And I think they just thought, well, that's enough. You know, the time, let's get this over with. The time to die is now. And so they hold up in this printworks. They didn't take any hostages. They didn't kill the boss who was there, or there was a young man who was hiding who they never discovered. But so their aim wasn't to just kill as many people as possible. I'm talking about the Quashu brothers. They wanted to kill specific people.
Yeah.
And once they'd done that, they just wanted to die in combat against the police, which, they achieved pretty easily. Once the French worked out where they were, they sent a lot of elite troops there. And I think it took about 90 seconds once the brothers had emerged from the print works out into the open. They were dead pretty soon.
It's strange because this is a story that begins sort of with the media and it ends with the media, because I guess the police in both cases were trying to get a hold of the perpetrators and the media beat them to it. When the Quashu brothers spoke to the media over the phone, they kept saying they're not bloodthirsty. They said, we don't kill civilians. Did they view these journalists and these cartoonists as legitimate targets in the larger cultural war?
Undoubtedly. They didn't consider the cartoonists to be civilians. They didn't consider them to be worthy of protection or being accorded the title of civilian. They also said, you know, we don't kill women, and that's not true. They killed a woman inside the Charlie Hebdo office. So there's sort of selective truth-telling there. But, certainly they gave the impression that they weren't slaughtering people at random. Unlike the November attacks that happened in Paris in the same year, which was a random slaughter, these two brothers were... they're out to kill specific people, and once they'd done that, they were happy to go to their death. So in a sense, what he's saying is true. They didn't kill the petrol station attendant, the gas station attendant, sorry. They didn't kill the printworks owner whom they came across. They could easily have killed. But, you know, when you see the forensic pictures from inside the Charlie Hebdo office, I mean, I don't think, certainly not true to say that they're not bloodthirsty. That was a terrible, bloody massacre.
Yeah.
And those pictures are some of the most shocking I've ever seen.
Yeah. And it was interesting that they kept referring to the code of honor that they had. It's a weird rationalization, I guess.
Yeah. They feel that they're doing a good thing. They feel that they're fighting a good fight. They feel that what they're doing is pure and honest and true and motivated by only the best reasons. I mean, clearly, from our point of view, it's the exact opposite. But they do feel that. So that's the ideology they're locked into.
Yeah, well, let's talk about their brother-in-arms here. There was another terrorist, like I said, named Coulibaly, who gunned down a police officer in the streets shortly after the Hebdo attack. And at the same time as the Quashu brothers were having their standoff in Demartin, he had taken hostages at a kosher grocery store in Paris. He claimed that he was affiliated with the Islamic State, and he claimed that he was in collusion with the Quashu brothers. He did, as you just mentioned earlier, know them. Was this a case of coordinated attacks, or was he riding on their coattails to some extent?
I think he was more riding on their coattails. I think this is an individual who was a criminal, unlike the Quashu brothers. This was a guy who's an armed robber. He's a kind of ne'er-do-well. He was a convert. Had a different social profile to the two brothers. So I think that's probably why they wouldn't let him in on their operation. So it's true. They did meet in prison, and they did let him know by text message that they were beginning their attack. But I don't think there was any coordination other than that. And he's certainly tried to make out in his suicide, in his martyrdom video, you know, his declaration, video declaration before he went into the kosher deli. He tried to make out that he had find, you know, he'd kind of supported them with money and funds and weapons and stuff.
Yeah.
In fact, he was instructed to do this by an email from an Islamic State operative, I believe.
Oh, he was. Okay.
Yeah,
so his claims
yeah,
of being associated with the Islamic State were legitimate.
Yes. So there was the French authorities found email correspondence between Koulibaly and someone who's presumed to be an Islamic State handler, who is a French speaker, probably a French native, judging by the slang that was used in the email. So, yeah, it was kind of along the lines of, well, you know, we're not going to be able to get you a partner. You're going to have to do things kind of pick your own target. When you record your martyrdom video, try and give the impression, you know, try and make sure you say that we funded those other guys and what have you. So,
yeah,
and I think that was misleading. So this is a different kind of individual. He's, you know, markedly less intelligent, I think, less educated, more of a ruffian, more of a gangster.
You seem to indicate in the film that his first attack where he shot the police officer was probably an attack gone wrong that was intended for a Jewish target. Is that right? For a synagogue or something like that?
We don't know for sure, but this seems the most likely explanation as to what he was doing there. There is a Jewish school right around the corner. And this was, the attack took place in the morning in the early hours. And it was, I think, just after all the pupils had gone into the school. So I think he might have arrived late, might have mistimed it. But that's presumption.
Right.
That's what the Paris police, opinions are divided as to whether he really was setting out to attack the Jewish school or not. But that, it provides a logic for his presence in that area. There's no explanation for it otherwise.
Well, yeah, and he did follow it up with the attack on the kosher deli or the kosher grocery store, which and I think it was even around the time of a Jewish holiday, wasn't it?
Well, it was just he attacked on the Friday, so just before.
Right. Oh, of course, yeah. By the Sabbath. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I've heard that many in the Jewish population in France are now fleeing for Israel and elsewhere because they don't feel safe there. In your talks with some of the hostages and the relatives of the victims of Koulibaly, did you get a sense of this?
Very much so. I think Jews in Paris particularly feel threatened, and with good cause. There are soldiers outside every synagogue, outside every Jewish school. I find it quite shocking as a Brit. You know, we don't have that. We don't have that kind of problem. I don't think that, you know, there are times when police are stationed outside particular places, but this is a routine presence. This is a routine presence of
really
men with loaded guns. You know, troops outside every single synagogue in Paris. And that's kind of alarming, isn't it? And there's just a general sense of, yeah, not feeling safe. So a lot of people are leaving for Israel. A lot of people are leaving for the States. But then you do get some of the hostages from the kosher deli told me, you know, we're French. This is where we were born. This is where we'll stay. You know, we're not going to get intimidated. We're not going to leave the country we love just because of these threats. So there's, I'd say, a 50-50 kind of split between those who will not stay because it's just too dangerous and those who want to, you know, who want to stay because they feel French.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll talk more with documentary filmmaker Dan Reed when we come back in just a moment. Hey, folks, do you like reading but find it's getting harder and harder to make time to curl up with a good book? Well, there's a solution. Give audiobooks a try. They're perfect for your commute to work or working out at the gym, a relaxing bath, or any time, really. And right now, you can take an audiobook for a spin with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickassnews to get a free 30-day trial and download any of Audible's 180,000 titles entirely for free. That's audibletrial.com/kickassnews. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. You were already filming this documentary and interviewing people involved around the time of the November 2015 Paris attacks. At that time, did the authorities and law enforcement indicate to you that they felt confident that they had improved and had control of the security situation in France?
I think they would have liked to have felt that way. I don't think, honestly, that they could claim to have taken control of the situation, and clearly events proved that. I was recording one of the very last interviews in the film in our studio, which is actually just down the street from one of the attack sites later that day, where 19 people were killed, literally on the corner of our street where we had our studio. And I was recording an interview with the chief medic of the Paris Fire Department, and this is a very brave man who was one of the first into the Charlie Hebdo office. And you know, he was very emotional. He said that, you know, the terrorists are willing to die for their ideas, but we Frenchmen too, we will die for what we believe in. And gave a real kind of, you know, rousing kind of rebuttal to the terrorists' ideology. But, you know, he walked out of there, and then I think 4 or 5 hours later, he was at the Bataclan trying to save some of the hundreds of people who were injured there. And, you know, 90 people died that night. Just at the Bataclan and another 40 elsewhere in Paris.
You know, and what's amazing to me is going back to the 70s, this has been going on, you know, this consistent stream of attacks by radical Islamists in France. Mm. And every time people post memes or they hold candlelight vigils, but then it seems a few months or maybe a year later, it happens all over again. Do you think the French government is finally taking this seriously?
I think they're taking it very seriously. I think that they're hampered by the polarization of French society and the alienation of a lot of young Muslims. And this is a pool of recruits and a pool of young men, especially, who are very angry, who feel they don't have a stake. They can't be French, and they can't, you're not accepted as Frenchmen, and they cling to other forms of identity. And I think that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem is that the terrorist networks have been allowed to spread and mobilize and really establish themselves in these kind of ghetto-like areas in France and in Belgium. And then there's also the problem with the response. I think the authorities simply didn't have a grip on how to respond to certainly the January attacks and the November attacks too. I think, you know, there's a steep learning curve. I hope that now France is better prepared.
The French take the opening of a McDonald's as an assault on their culture, and yet this was allowed to go on under their nose, whole neighborhoods of Paris and Marseille falling under Sharia law. I don't understand. Where was the cultural outcry there?
Right. I mean, I don't think that I don't think it's quite true to say that whole neighborhoods were under Sharia law. Certainly, a lot of neighborhoods were under the control of criminal gangs who happened to be youth of Algerian descent or, you know, Muslim youths. But so there was a sort of an out-of-control zone, but I don't know the extent to which Sharia law was current there. But it's certainly true to say that, if you look at the Burkini ban,
right?
You've heard of that, right?
Yes, of course.
So this was kind of an absurdity because any Muslim woman who's going to go to the beach and, you know, in a burkini or in a bikini, doesn't really matter. Any Muslim woman who's kind of allowed to go to the beach by male relatives is not a fundamentalist. You know, women who are in that ideology simply don't go to the beach.
Okay.
Full period. So Muslim women who are at the beach in burkinis are not the kind of women who are going to threaten French society. And, you know, so it seemed like hitting a butterfly with a hammer, you know. It's just going to make things worse. The ban was overturned by the authorities, but I think it shows you the kind of ineffectual response and the misunderstanding of where the problem really is. You know, the problem doesn't lie with, you know, women in headscarves or not. I mean, this is my view. But, you know, this isn't. There's no point lashing out at the symbols of the Muslim faith. You need to tackle people who want to do harm. You need to tackle the terrorists. You need to tackle people who are making plans to blow people up and kill innocent people. And the French state has not been particularly effective, and I think they would agree with that, not been particularly effective up to now. They have unearthed a few plots, but I think they've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you, you know, they are fighting this cultural war against Islam, but are they putting enough effort into stopping terrorism?
I think, you know, in order to get a grip on terrorism, you need to have human intelligence. You need to have informants. You need to have people you need to have a groundswell of support in the communities that from where your attackers are going to come, right? So you need to isolate the terrorists in their home territory. And I don't think that the French government, although they've clearly tried and they clearly want to, I don't think they've done this very effectively. I think there's been a real, you know, problem in getting the kind of support that will bleed the terrorists of their, there's a very big truck has driven past.
No problem. You can start
that again.
Yeah.
I think so. The French authorities haven't been able to penetrate the communities that the terrorists typically come from, and so there's a lack of human intelligence, there's a lack of cooperation, there's a lack of goodwill in the community, and until you get that, you're never going to be able to predict who's going to pick up a gun and go or drive a truck into a crowd of people. You know, You have to have that human intelligence, you have to have those informants, you have to have that flow of information. Otherwise, no amount of SWAT teams, no amount of, you know, searches and hard stops and martial law, no amount of that will keep you safe.
When you talked to some of the survivors from the Charlie Hebdo office, did you ever encounter anyone who backed down a little bit or seemed to feel that, well, maybe this isn't worth it?
No, and I don't think any of them would publicly say this. Mm-hmm. I think there were internal discussions before the attack as to how far we should take this line of satire. The satirization of the Prophet Muhammad and Muslims and what have you. I think there were internal discussions, and there was talk about, you know, to what extent it was advisable to do it given the number of death threats they were receiving. I think once it had happened, I think people closed ranks and people, you know, rallied behind the spirit of Charlie Hebdo, which was to fearlessly criticize anyone and everyone.
Yeah, but it does say something that there were several subjects in the film that didn't want to show their face. I mean, clearly there are people who are still scared that they could be targeted.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, the majority of the surviving journalists are so well known and so easily recognized that there's no point for them. There's Laurent Léger, the journalist that I interviewed, who's their kind of investigative correspondent, investigative reporter, he quite openly showed his face. He's a very brave man. And he's a man who, has given a couple of interviews and certainly isn't hiding his face. But the receptionist or the subscriptions manager, who's the other person I interviewed from Charlie Hebdo, she wanted to hide her face. She didn't want to be recognized. And I found that also some of the police officers in the area, kind of lower ranking, the patrol officers, didn't want to show their face. The gendarme who'd been part of the team that actually put a bullet in one of the terrorists at the Printworks, she didn't want to show her face, and that really struck me because in the United States and certainly and probably in England as well, that police officer would have been a hero, right? And she would have come out and shown her face and gone, "We did a great thing," and got credit for it. Whereas in France, she is afraid to show her face because she's afraid of retaliation from the local Muslim youth.
Yeah, understandably so. You know, here in America, we take freedom of speech very, very seriously. And France, of course, has the land of Molière and Voltaire, so they have their cultural history of satire. Did you get a sense that they take freedom of speech as seriously as, say, we do?
Well, it's interesting that you asked that because, on the one hand, there was this incredible sense of injury caused by the attack on Charlie Hebdo, that this was really an attack, even if you disagreed. A lot of French people didn't particularly appreciate Charlie Hebdo. They thought it was a little bit excessive, a little bit shrill, but childish. But the attack on Charlie Hebdo was it really felt like a real assault on fundamental French, something fundamentally French. So yes, everyone came in the streets, and the whole Je suis Charlie phenomenon that rang around, resounded around the world. That all suggested that the French were really clung to their freedom of speech. But on the other hand, working in France, I found it to be quite a place where information is fairly restricted, and that the government does keep its card very close to its chest. It doesn't necessarily share information with journalists, and in fact has quite a punitive attitude towards, you know, if a journalist gets a document or a journalist shows things that they're not supposed to show. Not just the French authorities, but the French society itself seems not to really encourage the free sharing of information. That may be a bit harsh. I may be overstating that slightly, but certainly I found that the French were, you know, the polar opposite of what I find in the United States, where people are very willing to share, willing to speak out, willing to express themselves, willing to share information, where the government makes information available, by and large, not all of it. But in France, I found the opposite attitude, actually.
Before we go, I want to ask you about your native country, the UK.
Yes.
You've also had some issues with Sharia law taking over certain areas in the UK. Do you think that the Brits have gotten a fix on that, or are handling it any better than the French at this point?
I think I'd preface my answer by saying I don't agree that Sharia law has any foothold in the UK.
Okay.
I think it may be, you know, certainly there are communities that are where disputes are taken to Sharia court, and that's true. That's widespread in the in the areas with a high, particularly Pakistani population in the UK. But I don't think it's not as if there's Sharia law in the streets. You know, it's
okay.
Like if you're, you know, that's not accurate.
Okay.
Have we got a grip on the kind of problems that the French are encountering with their French Muslim populations? I think more so. I won't say that there aren't parts of the UK where, you know, you have pockets of very alienated young men who might be, you know, possibly who'd sympathize with Islamic State. And certainly we've sent our fair share of Islamic State fighters or recruits to go and fight in Syria. But I think the problems, the bitterness and the kind of, you know, I think there is a place in English culture and British culture for someone who's a Muslim. And it's you know, and there is a place for you if you're from a different culture, if you're from a different faith. I don't think it's that difficult, particularly in the big cities, to integrate and to feel at home and to feel that you're accepted. I think it's much harder in France to feel, if you're an Arab or a Muslim, I think it's much harder to feel French. It's not impossible. Yeah. There are plenty of, you know, very successful and French Muslims in the government. There are plenty of fresh, successful French Muslims in culture. But I mean, overall, I think they have there's a much more of a gulf, a chasm between France's Catholics and Jews and its Muslims. And you don't have that issue in the UK.
By the way, Brexit, thumbs up or thumbs down?
A big thumbs down, I'm afraid. I mean,
well, I mean, yeah. In your opinion,
it was a crazy thing to do. People didn't even understand the consequences of it. The most popular Google search the day after the Brexit vote was "What is Europe?" And people didn't understand what they were doing. And we're going to be, you know, the problems that people voted about, the fear of immigration, the fear of loss of control of our borders, the fear of laws being taken over by Brussels, very little of that is going to be made better by leaving the European Union. You know, there's a complete misconception. And we're going to lose so much. We're going to lose economically to such a huge extent that our security is going to be affected just by the fact that we're going to be a poorer country.
Yeah.
I think that was a huge blast in the foot with a shotgun, both barrels.
Yeah, I think it's just starting to set in, too.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to move to America.
Well, you know what? You better get over here before Trump takes over then. You better hurry.
He's going to put a wall at JFK.
Yeah. Well, I highly recommend people see the film. It's definitely worth watching. It's called 3 Days of Terror, The Charlie Hebdo Attacks. It airs on Monday, September 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern on HBO. Dan Reed, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks again to Dan Reed for coming on the show. 3 Days of Terror, The Charlie Hebdo Attacks, airs tonight, Monday, September 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern on HBO. You can also watch 3 Days of Terror and several other documentaries by Dan Reed anytime you want on HBO On Demand, HBO Go, or HBO Now. To learn more, visit HBO.com. You can visit Dan on the internet at amospictures.co.uk and follow him on Twitter at @DanReed1000. Be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. And if you really want to help out, then donate to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickassnews. Or if you prefer, you can set up a recurring monthly contribution at Patreon.com/kickassnews. You can visit Kick-Ass News on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at @KAPolitics. And please be sure to recommend Kick-Ass News to all your friends on your social media. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnewspodcast.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.